My name is Rick Kleffel, and welcome to Fine Print. Today we're talking to Ramsey Campbell, the British writer of psychological and supernatural horror. He's the author of 29 novels, 17 short story collections, and the editor of 17 anthologies. His latest novels are The Pact of the Fathers from Tor, an absorbing thriller about parents and children and a woman who uncovers her father's sinister past, The Darkest Part of the Woods from the famous British small press publisher PS Publishing, and Tor has recently released his latest short story collection, Ghosts and Grisly Things, and his latest anthology is Meddling with Ghosts. Welcome to Fine Print, Ramsey.
Hey, Rick. Nice to meet you.
With all these projects, it's no wonder you're a horror writer. Presumably in the time when you're not sleeping, you're writing. But you've also been writing since quite an early age. Could you tell us why you started writing, what you first wrote, and how you sold it?
Gee, that's several questions all at once, but all right. The very first thing I wrote, and we're going back before I was published, actually, was back when I was 11 years old. I actually did a complete collection of short stories. I mean, they were really very short, but they did have some pretension toward narrative continuity and narrative closure. A book called Ghostly Tales, and it was written in, you know, pen, and it was illustrated in crayon, and so little did I know that I actually sent off this object, the only copy thereof, to various publishers in Britain, who duly returned it, as well you can imagine. The only line I would like to quote from it, to give you some indication of its prose style, is a sentence that runs, "The door banged open, and the aforementioned skeleton rushed in." But I'll tell you what, I got one very encouraging letter from Tom Boardman Jr., who ran one of the very few British publishers then in the 50s doing science fiction in hardcover. And he wrote back saying, basically, "We do not publish ghost stories, so we have to return this. But, you know, given your age, we feel you have every chance of making the grade if you keep at it." So these were fighting words to an 11-year-old. 3 years passed, and I discovered H.P. Lovecraft in a big way. I mean, I'd been reading him for quite a few years in anthologies, but this was the first book of his work I ever discovered, a book called Cry Horror, which, you know, contained some of his very finest stuff, like The Colour Out of Space, and frankly, some of his worst, like The Moon Bog. But the fact remains that, you know, I was able to read a whole wodge of Lovecraft in a single day. I just took the day off school, frankly, and pleaded sick and sat at home and read this from cover to cover. And I tell you, I mean, I was not merely was I convinced that this was the greatest horror fiction I'd ever read, but I actually thought this is the greatest fiction I'd ever read. Well, you know, I was 14 years old, so it was a bit over the top. But nevertheless, I knew this is what I wanted to do, and I wanted to repay some of the pleasure that I'd gained from this. And so I set out to do it very, very slavishly, very imitatively. I mean, to the extent that even though I'd never been more than maybe 20 miles from Liverpool in England, I was writing stuff set in Massachusetts. And by gum, did it show that I'd never been to Massachusetts, particularly when the rustics opened their mouths. Okay, nevertheless, I sent this off to August Derleth at Arkham House, which was then Lovecraft's publisher, and of course, you know, also basically a publisher that specialised in horror fiction, a one-man show run by August Derleth. And they sent me back a letter. I mean, all I'd really wanted was some comment. I didn't, you know, it was not, "Please publish my unpublished book." But he sent me back a huge, well, very, very substantial double-spaced, I beg your pardon, he sent me back a very substantial single-spaced two-page A4 editorial letter telling me exactly what was wrong with the book, which was a very considerable amount, however saying that if I was prepared to do all this work, then he saw this as being maybe a potential Arkham House book. Well, you know, at 15, that was pretty heady stuff, and you may well imagine that I went ahead and I did all the work he felt I should, including transferring all the stuff to England, and inventing a kind of Seven Valley setting, which was a kind of English equivalent to Lovecraft's Arkham setting, and basically getting the characters to talk to each other, which they hadn't done previously, and basically modernising the narrative technique. So, you know, even at this very early stage, I was learning. And the most important thing of all, I think, was that I had a very good forthright editorial input very early in my career, and you can get nothing better than that.
Boy, that's fantastic. So at 15, you were already getting seriously considered for publishing. When was that published?
Well, the first story was when I was 16, so that was back in 62. However, it's worth saying that I sent this to Derleth because he was doing a new anthology of all new fiction. He actually said, you know, did I have something in my rewrites that maybe he could look at with the view to publishing it. I sent him a story which is then called The Tomb Herd, and you can understand why he changed the title to The Church in High Street. And he sent me back a letter saying basically, if I was prepared to let him have an editorial free rein over the story, then he was prepared to buy it. Now, I mean, I wouldn't, obviously, these days, you should never let an editor go full tilt at your story without any comeback. But nevertheless, again, it meant that I was going to be published in this book, which turned out to be alongside, people like Robert Bloch and H. Russell Makefield and so on. So that was temptation enough. And so I said, okay, and signed the contract. And he did do a lot of very necessary revision, particularly in terms of concentrating the narrative more. Now, there were things that I would have done differently, but nevertheless, the point was clearly he felt that it was the best way to show me how to do it was to do it himself. And having been inspired by this example, I then did go ahead and rewrite the other stories that I'd done so far and wrote about as many again to bulk out a complete book. And those were very considerably technically better than the ones I'd first sent to him. And in fact, he didn't see the need to make any major editorial changes when he got the rest of them, and so he published his first book of mine, and here I was, 18 years old, an Arkham House writer. Never
Wow.
looked back.
And that book was The Inhabitant of the Lake.
Exactly.
Now, Arkham House is surely an important name in American horror publishing. Could you tell us a bit about who they are and their importance to you as both a reader and a writer?
Well, yeah, I mean, they were set up by August Erth and also his friend Donald Wandrei back in 1939, specifically to publish the first hardcover collection of Lovecraft's short stories, The Outsider and Others, which contained, well, what certainly they saw most of the best of Lovecraft's work. Along came a second volume pretty soon after to publish the rest of the work. And from that, Derleth then began to see it, I think, as a publisher for hardcover publication of other writers who'd, particularly those who contributed to Weird Tales magazine, which was, a pulp of the 20s and 30s and all the way into the 50s. So he did the first book publication of people like Robert E. Howard, Clark Ashton Smith, Robert Bloch, Ray Bradbury had his first book. Indeed, it's interesting that Derleth actually specialised for quite a while in doing the first hardcover collection of quite a variety of writers. I mean, if I had to choose one apart from Lovecraft, it would be my personal essential Arkham House writer. It would be Fritz Leiber with Night's Black Agents, which was his first book, and again an Arkham House book, and crucial, I think, to the development of the modern horror story, because it not merely does it set it in the big modern city, first Chicago and later San Francisco, but also whereas in the past, that sort of setting would be invaded by the supernatural. In Fritz's case, crucially, the supernatural comes out of the setting. It's an aspect of modern urban existence. I think that's one of the key turning points of the modern supernatural horror story. So anyway, I mean, Arkham House basically has been going now since the very late 30s, and it's still going. I mean, it's now, I think, I believe it is returning to its trawling of the pulp magazines. So apparently, we're going to see more pulp writers back into hardcover from Arkham House quite soon.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Now, the 80s were known as a heyday for horror. Could you talk about how that burst of popularity affected your writing?
Well, it affected it in terms of publication, without any question. Although, really, I'd started writing, having done short stories and been published with short stories since the early 60s, I didn't actually do a novel until the mid 70s. And it was several years of writing novels before. I struck anything like, well, I don't even say gold, but at least, some kind of relatively not base metal. And again, you're absolutely right, it was the early 80s, a book called The Parasite, actually, which took off for me. I mean, frankly, I think it's my worst novel. It's very much a kind of, a novel into which all sorts of supernatural elements are more or less shoehorned. I think there's just a few too many, I like bits of the book, but nevertheless, it was certainly the kind of big, sort of flashy supernatural extravaganza that was selling well in those days, and it did enable me to feel secure as a writer, and from then on, really, to write the kind of thing that I wanted to write and develop what I was trying to do. But I mean, that boom was obviously very important. On the other hand, there's no question whatsoever that far too much was being published. I mean, every publisher wanted their six horror titles a month, and there just are not that many to go around that are any good.
Right. Now, horror was split into two factions during the 80s. One faction took some of the extremes we saw in Clive Barker's The Books of Blood even further, and these writers call themselves splatterpunks in response to science fiction's cyberpunks. You, on the other hand, were an avatar of so-called quiet horror. Could you talk about what happens when a genre experiences this kind of explosion of invention and schizophrenia?
Well, I think, to be honest, it's more a phase that it went through, and this kind of, you know, face-off was really a bit of a false dichotomy. I mean, that there always have been writers, and I think I'm one of them, who you know, when the occasion demands, you write very suggestively and write a show just enough to suggest far, far worse, actually, or something far larger than you can actually directly show. But on the other hand, if you need to write, you know, graphic violence for the purpose of the story, then you do that too. I mean, look as far back, for heaven's sake, as Poe. You know, on the one hand, you have, you know, very visionary stuff like The Fall of the House of Usher, but equally you have stuff which, for the time, is really pretty grim, like, say, The Black Cat, which is, you know, mutilation of animals, for heaven's sake. You know, it doesn't mess about. Even Clive Barker, in a way, although certainly, you know, he made his name initially with very graphic stuff, but graphic stuff which seems to me to be imaginatively vital, rather than, you know, graphic stuff which is really a sort of regurgitation of details of the page, as kind of a substitute for imagination. I mean, Clive is one of the imaginative breed, but nevertheless, even he, you know, quite early on was getting subtler. I mean, stuff like In the Hills, the Cities is not a graphically violent story. It's a graphic in the sense of extremely painterly and visionary. This huge image which you probably could convey either in a painting or in prose, but that's not quite the same thing as I'm afraid far too many of the bunch, not necessarily the splatterpunks, but that whole movement in the 80s and 90s. There seemed to be all any number of writers whose sole aim was to try and outdo one another in terms of how disgusting they could get, and that just isn't interesting. It's not good art. That's what's wrong with it.
Right. Now, you published several novels and some short story collections with Santa Cruz-based Scream Press, helmed by Jeff Connor. How did this venture come about?
Well, now, the first thing I'm right in saying I'm sure that Jeff ever published was a collection, far too belated, really, Dennis Etchison's first hardcover collection, which was The Dark Country. And he actually, we met at a convention here shortly before he did that book. And to be honest, I cannot now remember what city it was in, because these do tend to merge in my old senile memory after a while. But okay, certainly, he said he was going to do this book, and he asked me to do an introduction to The Dark Country, which I duly did once we'd met. And I'm not absolutely certain who it was. It may have been J.K. Potter, who illustrated The Dark Country and all my Scream Press books as well. It was certainly somebody who suggested to him that what he actually wanted to do was a short story collection of mine. What it may have been my suggestion was that he ought to do the first hardcover edition of The Face That Must Die, which was my second novel, which all my publishers who had done the first one, almost to a man or woman, said was far too grim to publish. And it was this classic thing of, you know, there are no sympathetic characters. Well, as far as I'm concerned, there don't have to be any sympathetic characters in a work of fiction. I'm with Nabokov on that. All they need to do is be interesting, you know?
Sure.
I mean, it's the quality of the prose that I want to read, not whether I can identify comfortably with the characters. In some ways, I think fiction is a very good place to meet people you'd ordinarily cross the street to avoid, or the city to avoid, you know? So, I mean, The Face That Must Die had been published in Britain in a paperback original eventually in the late 70s, but I'd lost so much faith in it that I'd actually cut bits out of it because I thought that they slowed the narrative down. And I decided that what would be good would be to do, you know, a restored, complete version of the thing. And Jeff, to his eternal credit, felt that this was a good idea and that the book should be given, you know, its chance the way I'd written it. And J.K. Potter more than rose to the occasion with some of the more deranged images of his career, I think. And that book was published in the early 80s and did get quite a reputation for itself. Eventually went into paperback, and years later, I was in an American airport, it may have been Atlanta, and I saw a wire stand in the one of the airport bookstores full of copies of The Face That Must Die. Now, I would not want to sit on a long-haul flight next to somebody reading that book, let me tell you.
Now, you've also collaborated with J.K. Potter on a couple of other works. Could you tell us about writing your novel, The Influence, which is certainly one of my favorites, and the collaborative effort that you and Mr. Potter made on that novel?
Well, sadly, I mean, it never came ultimately to precisely what we wanted it to come to. I mean, that was going to be my last, or my latest, I should say, rather, Scream Press book. It had been published in Britain, it had been written and published, but Jeff Connor very much wanted to do an illustrated, limited edition, and JKE came to stay with us in Liverpool, and he and I and my daughter, who was in many ways the little girl in the book, went to the various locations I'd used in it, all the way from North Wales to Liverpool, which are actually, you can see one from each from the other across the bay, but it takes a very much longer time to get from one point to the other by road, which is one of the keys to the book, in fact. And he shot her in all sorts of locations and made her into this ghostly figure in very subtle ways. I mean, I think it's some of J.K.'s subtlest work, and he was convinced that he'd reached a new side to himself by doing these images. But sadly, not long after that, Scream Press imploded. It's unclear why. I mean, perhaps it was just so luxury of press that it couldn't quite sustain its own expenses, and so the book never appeared. Not this limited edition. However, luckily, nearly all the images that J.K. made do appear in his collection Horripilations, which is, you know, a big British collection of his art. So you can still see my daughter at, oh, I think 10 years old, in a variety of spectral situations.
Now, you've written a huge number of short stories. What takes some ideas into the novel-length format while others remain as short stories?
Well, for me, it's purely instinctive. I mean, I basically, there are, as you quite correctly say, there are novel ideas and there are short story ideas, and I think one of the crucial things is to develop an instinct for which is which, and not to try and you know, write a bloated short story and pretend it's a novel. But equally, you know, you don't want to take a novel idea and do it less than justice by reducing it to the length of a short story. I honestly don't know. I mean, I've never really known exactly what the difference is. I think it has to be simply the one that generates the most narrative ideas. I mean, in my early days, I would plot a novel completely, and I'd actually write a notebook full of ideas, and then I would index them by the chapters they would appear in, having plotted the thing in advance. But these days I don't. These days I just gather as many ideas really as the thing appears to be capable of generating. I suppose it's that actually that ultimately decides for me which is going to be. If the number of ideas it's generating go beyond a certain point, it's very clearly going to be a novel, or at the very least a novella, of which I've done, well, one good one, I think.
We're here with Fine Print with Ramsey Campbell. Ramsey, from the beginning, your novels and short stories have demonstrated a very precise and economical use of language. Each word that you write seems carefully chosen to convey a specific tone and image. Could you talk about how you developed your prose style?
Well, with great difficulty is probably the immediate answer. I mean, certainly initially by imitating Lovecraft, his prose and his use of particularly of adjectives, I'm afraid, which is something luckily I was teased away from by August Derleth quite early on. I began to develop what I'd recognise as my own style. When I was in my late-ish teens, when having read all the classics of horror, I began to read, or began much more thoroughly to read, in the mainstream, and particular favourite writers most certainly had an influence. Two of whom, I suppose, would be Graham Greene, still an enormous favourite, and perhaps my all-time favourite 20th century writer, Nabokov. I mean, Lolita was an enormous revelation to me of just how much more you could do with prose than simply use the very legitimate Poe technique of organising everything toward the single effect. I mean, it seems to me that there's so much more fun you can have with prose, and this was what Nabokov, not only Lolita, but Pale Fire and Real Life of Sebastian Knight and many another novel demonstrated to me. And this is what I now wanted to do. So basically I fell in love with prose, and frankly, I think if you're not in love with prose, you've no business writing at all, as far as I'm concerned. And yeah, it's just basically trying to find new ways to say things, maybe to say familiar things, or to if there's one ambition I have, whatever I'm writing, is to try and make you, which is to say me as well as anybody, look again at things we've taken for granted. I think that's one of the things that the prose ought to be about, to use familiar language in a new way. And actually, the older I get, the longer it takes, but it still seems to me to be worth doing.
Now, even your most overtly supernatural stories have a real deep and resonant psychological basis. Could you talk about the part that human psychology plays in all your stories?
Well, as you say, very, 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 very crucial. I suppose if I had to sum it up, it would be that in my stuff, the supernatural element, in those stories where it is supernatural, because there are quite a few that are not, particularly the novels, half a dozen of them have no supernatural element. But in those that do, it's fair to say, I think, that the supernatural element is often a projection of something about the character, the protagonist, that they've suppressed or don't want to admit to themselves. It's kind of a distorting mirror out there which is holding them up to themselves. But I think what's crucial for me is that the psychological element can't be used to explain away the supernatural. It still has some sort of ambiguously objective existence at the very least.
That's very interesting. Your fiction revolves a lot around relationships between parents and children, and children themselves are recurrent themes in your fiction, and you yourself are a parent. Could you talk about how the parent, as a writer, feels about terrorizing the children who are his characters?
Well, I think it's fundamentally the fear of the parent that's feeding into my stuff from very early on, when my children were very young. It is the terror of what might happen to them. Is an additional layer of terror that's been in my stuff for, I suppose, the last couple of decades. But I mean, funnily enough, even much earlier than that, I mean, a decade or more before I was ever a parent or even probably married, there's an old story of mine called The Scar, where this notion of the vulnerability of children first surfaces, where, you know, these two children are being terrorized in some unspecified but clearly very nasty way by someone who is substituted for their father, and are taken back by a would-be helpful neighbor who feels, you know, parents have absolute rights over their children, and whatever happens next door is fine by him, and he won't intervene. And I think this recurs throughout my stuff. I mean, there's a relatively recent novel, The Last Voice They Hear, where the psychotic at the centre of things has kidnapped his brother's little boy and realises that however badly he behaved to this kid in public, people are simply going to think he's a parent because this is the way parents do behave in public, and they don't feel that they can really intervene. Now, that actually seems to me to have an edge of terror that certainly makes me uneasy. And, you know, that is the sort of thing that basically tends to resurface in my stuff. But there's also, obviously, that, you know, increasingly in some of the later novels, there's a whole fear that the parent, i.e. me, might turn into a monster in some way. It's the, you know, it's the terror of the tensions within the family kind of emerging through me, which is why, for instance, you know, the father in Nazareth Hill becomes increasingly monstrous as the whole thing progresses. That's really me looking askance at myself.
We're here with Ramsey Campbell on Fine Print. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back after a moment.